You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
G'day, Annie McLaughlin here for this week's edition of Stick Together, the only national program focusing on union news, workers' stories and social justice issues. This program is produced in Melbourne for 3CR and broadcast across the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. On the stolen lands of the Kulin Nation, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. Despite some pretty disturbing things happening around us, NTEU, the National Tertiary Education Union members at Monash in particular, and in the university sector in general, will be celebrating a huge win in court as Monash has been forced by the federal court to pay almost $500,000 in unpaid wages to academics in a landmark settlement. We speak to Michael Chiaraviolo, one of the two lead applicants, about the win. We finished the program with a recognition of the International Day for Disability on December the 3rd. Workers who experience disability through work often have a hard road to walk. We hear one story from Danielle, who has found balance after years of struggle. You're on Stick Together, workers' stories, union news and social justice issues. The National Tertiary Education Union, the NTEU, has been raising the issue of wage theft at our universities for at least a decade. Last week, the federal court ruled against Monash University in a landmark case of underpayment of casual academics. Monash has been forced by the federal court to pay almost $500,000 in unpaid wages to academics in the landmark settlement. Monash argued that casuals directed to deliver student consultations without a separate payment was covered by tutorial rates. Justice John Snadder rejected the position and found the university breached agreements and failed to maintain records. We speak to Michael Chiaravolo, one of the two lead applicants, about the win. Well, congratulations on the win.
Oh, thank you very much.
Very interesting to me that you are actually a lecturer in banking and finance at Monash, and it seems extraordinary to me that Monash as an institution would believe that very highly credentialed, well aware workers would go on for years being given
underpaid
basically. Yeah.
Exactly. Look, I won't even lie to you, Annie. It was a discussion amongst a group of banking and finance accounting types, all in the business school, that really got this show on the road. And it really was down to someone who had some sort of co-discipline in law to be like, nah, look, I really think we've got a case here. And then as soon as someone explained to us that we might be being ripped off, it was very important that we make sure we're not being ripped off. And it turns out we had good reason to be concerned in the long run. Like, it, as soon as we started to quantify it as well and actually count up, because, you know, this thing was 10 years running, it's a significant amount of money for a lot of people. Like, it is sometimes a year or more's income owed in back pay. It is a significant amount.
They argued in the court that the work, and we have to explain to listeners, you were given a directive. It wasn't even a sort of, oh, we're just going to pretend. Yeah, no, it wasn't optional. You were given a directive that you had to actually do a student consultations, and that they believed that they were paying you based on the tutorial sessions that you were already being paid for.
It, to be honest, to me, it was nonsense, so much so that my first week on the job, way back when I was much brighter-eyed and rosier-cheeked, I actually claimed the hour for my consult and then was told by my management structure that, no, that's not how it's done. But yeah, you're correct. So really what this is about is these hours of dedicated, like one-on-one to one-on-a-few student support, you know, where you would normally traditionally go and meet with your lecturer, have a chat about what you're struggling with, maybe have a chat about some adjacent topic or some assignment, and it's not the classroom setting. Now, it's never been debated, and this was never the union stance, that a chat just after class, like for 5 minutes, isn't a part of the class, right? That's never what this was about. This was always about separately booked, entirely distinct, locked-in sessions that were somehow supposed to be, according to the university, included in what they were paying you for this class. But particularly as casual workers, well, if I'm not getting paid for a separate activity booked in at a separate time that I'm being directed to do, that I'm being told to schedule in and keep regular in advance, why am I not out earning money somewhere else to withholding of my time? Now, it was really about the removal of the flexibility of the choice, as well as just the sheer scale of this work. Like, some of us were in my faculty for particular, you know, we were doing a half hour consult for every hour of class we taught, which was somehow supposed to be, you know, covered within the same payment of that 1 hour class taught, which I don't think passes the pub test by any stretch, and turns out doesn't pass the legal test either.
I was actually thinking about it in your terms, you know, as a person who's actually run a business. I was thinking, how did the court come to almost $500,000 of unpaid work? But then, of course, it was all in your diaries, wasn't it?
Exactly correct. So it's in our diaries. And then, look, it is a bit of a higgledy-piggledy mess because every department, every faculty had different policies. So, for example, in my faculty, there was one policy. In arts, there was another. And that's one of the reasons why myself and James, sort of key witness evidentiary points, we were there to represent that this isn't a standard practice and that everyone's getting ripped off just a little bit differently. And the way that we could argue that this back pay would be easy to calculate is because it was almost always attached to something to do with this tutorial roll-up rate. And so in some faculties, it was, well, if you teach a tutorial, all you do X 1 or 2 hours a week. Sometimes it was based on the number of tutes, like in my case, or sometimes it was just 1 hour a week, no matter what. And it was always this thing of, well, there exists a record of the apparently rolled-up work that we were never paid because of. So it's pretty easy to translate that record across. And look, to be honest, in the end, like once we had won and had the ruling from His Honor and, you know, gone through the negotiations, Monash did reveal that, yes, it will be a scale to calculate. It will require some work, but it's not impossible. It's fairly straightforward. But that was why it was so important for the union to make sure that there was a dispute resolution scheme attached to the remediation process.
This was a business model that the university decided upon. They actually appeared to know that they were underpaying people, but they required a union to actually go for years of legal work in order to make this become clear to the public and to the law that this was what was going on. This is actually quite a difficult thing for unions to do. What I'm getting at is that the universities, this is Monash, it's happening right across the sector.
It's sector-wide.
Now, these administrations are falling back on the respectability of the past to represent themselves as not shonky.
They like to view it as an institution of prestige, right? That's what they want to project themselves to be. And certainly they've, perhaps in decades gone by, maybe, you know, before I was even alive, they earned that reputation. I happen to think that these days, amongst the people that are anywhere adjacent to the system, no one views it that way. These are, as you said, almost these corporate machines. Now, obviously, technically speaking, these are not for-profit institutions, right? They are backed by public money, they manage public money and all that technical stuff. But very directly, these decisions, this business practice was known by managers. It was known by the higher-ups. It was reported for years before the union felt the confidence to act. And that's fair. You know, if it's just one or two workers being exploited, it's very different than an entire class of workers. So the union had to gather a lot of information before it was certain that it wanted to progress. But the institution knew for much longer than that. They knew exactly what the practice was. They knew how beneficial it was. They knew that it would boost student engagement and student learning conditions basically for free. They were extracting free labor for a reason. It's because they had, you know, sort of a profit over education mindset. That's what it was. It was finance over educational quality. And the thing that I think you highlight there that really needs to be repeated to everyone is, I and, you know, some of my colleagues tried to correct this behavior, to get remediated before this was undertaken as a union effort. This never, and I want to stress that, never would be getting repaid, never would be leading to damages, never would be corrected, never would be recognized if it was not for the NTEU and the industrial officers and the, like, sort of the collective that got behind it. It would have been impossible. Being very direct, the initiators of this, they tried on their own, and you're never going to correct an institution with one person.
Because of the way that our law works, you have to have people who are prepared to put up their hands. So you're called the lead applicants. Now, that means that you two, Dr. James Kent and you, Michael, had to put up with this for years. This is a big strain, isn't it?
Look, I don't want to play the world's smallest violin and pretend like I suffered more than was right. Like, I was, to be clear, very happy to put my name on the line next to this. I was obviously, anyone could argue, you get a little nervous, making yourself more known and more perhaps targetable. But I was very confident in my local area, like my local area at the uni, that they, you know, my ability as a teacher, as a lecturer, as an academic, you know, made sure that, you know, no foul play would take place. Now, the other thing, you are correct, it was a lot of bloody work. It really, really was. There were many very quick deadlines that would appear out of nowhere. The legal system is chaos, but it was just a unending, like, Sisyphean amount of work every time with something happening. So much so that when we did finally go to the last mediation session recently, there was this moment quite late at night where it was actually over and no one could believe it. It's just, how could this be done? How could we have done it? It doesn't even make any sense. There was a lot of, you know, sort of sighs of relief more than anything else. But I know that in the long run, how I will look back on this, despite a massive amount of work, is that it was totally the right thing to do. Because there's going to be thousands of people made whole financially because of this. And unfortunately, you know, what we can't do is make them whole for the probably duress and stress that not having that income caused back in the day. But this should, you know, at least in some way, shape or form, make them feel vindicated. And that's the point, right? You do it not because of the one, but because of the many. And, you know, the fact that I got paid a little earlier than everyone else didn't hurt either.
This is just extraordinary, really, and more power
to
your arm.
Take your time. I love gas bagging about it. It's great. Yeah, I'm doing my victory lap.
Monash has agreed to submit monthly reporting requirements on the progress and scale of its remediation program through an independent oversight mechanism.
It was an important part from, honestly, both parties that there was some vetting mechanism, and something like this monthly reporting, it is integral to actually understanding how widespread this practice was at the end. Because we know our examples, right? We've got our evidentiary points. We know the number of people that affected it that have reported to us. But it could actually reveal through this remediation scheme that it was an even more widespread practice than we originally thought. There's probably an element of this reporting's going to, or this monthly sort of updating system is going to reveal, yeah, they knew what they were getting. They were getting a lot of free labor, a lot of free money. And it's going to reveal perhaps the underlying rot in the university governance system. We are probably talking over $10 million in back pay. That's our estimate at the moment. We have absolutely no hard figure. But, you know, that's an obscene amount of money. It's a problem this took place, and that it took so long to correct. The heel dragging and the fighting was a very intense thing.
I was looking at the report in the Australian Financial Review, and it made its class credentials quite clear, because it was talking about what that effect will have on businesses. And the effect it will have on the businesses is that now that the Albanese government has passed the wage theft legislation, that it gives an investment opportunity for unions to take court action and make it viable. Isn't that interesting?
From my discipline of finance, I know it makes me somewhat of a, you know, somewhat of a, I love that language, because it's true, right? This one for the union was a fight. It was hard fought. And it took years of work. And to look at that, stare that down the line at the beginning, like they knew they were doing, they knew what this would cost at the front. And that idea that it is now an investment, they are doing this up front because in the long run, it will pay dividends. It will be worth it in the long run.
You're on Stick Together, workers' stories, union news, and social justice issues. We finished the program to honour the workers who have had to deal with workplace accidents, which have changed their lives, as we celebrate the International Day of Disability on December the 3rd each year. I was lucky enough to have a conversation with a worker, Danielle, who had never expected to be forced to use the work cover system until an accident at work and long years of mental struggle has given her a new perspective on the strength of community to gain a new balance in her life.
Yeah, so I was working as a butcher, which I'd ended up in after being a chef. And trade work for probably 7 years. Yeah, and so I guess there was two things that I sort of felt the need to talk about. Was one, it sort of ended in a workplace injury when I was in a casual position and how that played out. And then the other thing is the sustained injuries that were discovered a few years after I'd already been in long-term unemployment for a couple of years, which aren't covered by Medicare. So, at the time of the workplace injury, which is a laceration to my thumb, I was in a casual position. I was in Sydney working for a big meat company, and the way it works is that the work cover situation, because I was casual, unlike full-time workers, where you would get a payment rate that is reflective of your full-time wage, they average out the previous month of work that you've done. So because it was at the end of January, I was kind of lucky because the previous month had been the biggest time of the year for butchers and I'd done a lot of hours. But as a casual worker, the work cover payments are incrementally decreased the longer you're on work cover until it reaches zero. And whilst that's decreasing, you're being tested regularly by, I was being tested regularly by the GP and, you know, validated or perhaps under scrutiny by the work cover company. And, you know, later on I found what became evident is that I don't know if they were definitely going to do it, whether I had the injury or not, but I suspect they were planning to starve me out of shifts anyway. And it was just an inconvenience that I'd got injured. Being between, you know, from Melbourne, but not having lived there for 12 years, my, you know, support networks were back here. And so I was eventually essentially transient and couch surfing whilst trying to maintain these very occasional shifts they were throwing me to show the work cover company that they were doing their part. Simultaneously, they were not paying me the amount that was they were supposed to pay me according to the work cover situation, and I had escalating psychiatric issues going on from other traumas that were unrelated to that, which were unacknowledged at the time, and eventually was told by the GP, effectively told, you have to stay in Sydney if you want to continue this work cover case and get the appropriate care and response. If you leave the state, the case has to be closed, which in hindsight I'd question, but I wasn't in a stable mental state to actually challenge that. I had to just go on the advice I'd had. I didn't have at the time any experience with unemployment or job seeker, and eventually closed the case and went back to Melbourne to be near family where I could be supported.
So what you're basically saying is that you sustained an injury, but the system was basically set up to, you know, chew you up and spit you out.
Pretty much. And because we know that so much of the workforce is now casualised, I think this is really important to know that you're not looked after if you happen to have an injury. So the system's no longer really supporting workers in terms of long-term care through the public system, which is what you end up with when you're unemployed. There's 5 sessions of allied health, which includes things like physiotherapists, psychologists, podiatrists and osteopaths. Now, you know, 5 sessions is nowhere near enough. It's only to treat a tiny flare-up, you know, let alone someone who sustains permanent injuries and needs sort of ongoing care and maintenance management plans. There are some community services which give sessions for $10, but, you know, if you're on JobSeeker, $10 a session, that's like more than a whole day's income. You know, the other part of that was that, yeah, later discovered that I'd, from that trade work of years, it's called disc desiccation of the spine, which they classify as a type of arthritis, but basically means the joints between some of in my lumbar spine are crumbling. And, you know, when that first happened, the free community groups, which was essentially mutual aid type thing, is, you know, there's not many of those sorts of things around, like hydrotherapy through ending up in, you know, to get care for, yeah, say $10 a session, which is still a lot of money when you're on JobSeeker. But
because what you're saying is that you're in constant pain and you've a developed condition that sets up a parameter around what kind of work you can do.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an ongoing, it's for the rest of my life now. I have to manage that pain and try and stay on top of it. Five sessions isn't enough.
Yeah, five sessions is definitely not enough. It's really just a band-aid, really, isn't it?
Yeah, the other part of that is, like, people can go and claim back date, take their former workplace to, you know, challenge them and say, oh, this is a sustained injury from long-term working for you. But legally, the opportunity to challenge it is apparently cut off at 7 years. Within that seven-year period, I couldn't mentally ever think of wanting to go through the hell of challenging the former workplace that I'd already just, you know, essentially escaped this punitive way of dealing with my work cover injury that time.
Because it's pretty alien, isn't it? I mean, going into legalese and trying to describe everything about your injury, it's quite a different world than from where you've been working.
Like, you go from one day being part of the team to the next day being treated with suspicion like you're abusing the system. Some of my managers, like, it was a big company, and some of these managers that had former smaller butchers themselves, and they go, oh, if this happened to me, I would have, you know, just told you to go go get on Centrelink and you know, see the back of you. Like, and so I'm, you know, it's not a great place for a woman to be in a very misogynistic, male-dominated workplace full of bravado that's telling you to, you know, you don't matter and to basically get lost, you know, whilst dealing with medical appointments and this work cover company that's, treating you with the scrutiny as if you're a criminal. Like, and then you go into the job seeker payment where they're giving you mutual obligations, and that kind of scrutiny and suspicion, the way they treat you is sustained for years. So it's a real toll.
Just tell me, you said that before you got this injury, you'd never really been unemployed before, had you?
No. So
was this a real eye-opener to you that,
I hadn't any experience with unemployment. I'd always had a job. I just thought I never expected to have a life without a job. I got my first part-time job when I was 13 because that was the work sort of ethic instilled in me. Having said that, I did grow up with the ignorance, perhaps, of not standing up for you know, award wages and not knowing about unions or that there was one. I worked under award wages from age 16, I think. And if I look back at that, my work history, I think there was only 3 years where I was probably paid award wages. I was still doing heaps of overtime, you know, even I had a profession as well before trade. So, yeah.
Yeah, so it's an interesting reversal, isn't it, to see why it's so important to push for a livable conditions, even if a person can't work.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, like I think my story is just one of many, many stories where it's not just about supporting people once they retire, you know, you cannot predict becoming unemployed or injured at any age. And, you know, I'd lived an able-bodied life and now I'm on the disability pension, not for the physical injuries, but, yes, part of that sustained mental load as well.
Did you try and get work after you identified as disabled in a sense?
I think I have probably only more recently in the last 7 years identified as disabled. I did when I briefly tried to go back into butchery when I came back to Melbourne, but it was really, everything was triggering me. Like, it just took me back to this kind of like abusive bullying time in my life, and really just wanted to see the back of it. I'd say I'm only now in a place where I can see maybe in 5 years I might have a different kind of role or paid work again sometime in my life. And identifying as disabled now doesn't mean that I'm unemployable, but I have to accept that, I feel like I have to accept that, perhaps this is my life just for today and now, that I'm not able to work. And unfortunately, you know, that's been a long time already to come to terms with that.
Do you think that there should be a little bit more of a reflection on society around how it handles people who aren't considered to be able-bodied? Because, I mean, in actual fact, having a disability of some sort is actually quite common.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, look, it's just not normalised. I think, you know, the capitalist system, everything's just so fast and aspirational, and able-bodied or able-minded is the norm. And someone said a term recently, just I learned, called pre-disabled. And you know, like, my story and my ailments aren't unique, and the fact that it happened in my 30s might have been a bit earlier than some people, but you know, if we're leaving people, like, the system is essentially disabling people. I would be an advocate for everyone just doing 3 days of paid employment and actually having a life outside of this this system that is so everyone's tied to debt and everything, you know, like, and that would allow some, you know, beautiful, fulfilling, like, you know, community engagement and actually, you know, being paid properly. Look, I volunteer with 3CR as activist or advocacy groups like the Unemployed Workers Union and Safe Public Housing, and in my community, like, things like being able to go to no cost or low cost things like a writer's group or an art group is the way I can have a fulfilling life and, yeah, engage with people. But 3CR has been an amazing part of that. So.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.